From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing to say things to you on the radio instead. Later in this episode, Lance Scott Walker will join us to discuss Houston Rap, a book chronicling Houston's rap scene. But first things first, we've got news to discuss. Joining me in the studio is Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder, who is just back from vacation in Colombia. Hey, Forrest.
Hola.
Welcome back, man.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Also with us is Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels, who I believe is picking sides in the war on Christmas even as we speak.
Happy holidays, Jonathan.
It's good to have you on the show, man. So let's talk about the war on Christmas. What's going on?
Yeah, the war on Christmas is the forever war, and it started up again this year, which is maybe a surprise if you were around the Capitol a few months ago. Thanks to State Rep. Dwayne Bohack and his Merry Christmas bill, it was supposed to be safe to say Merry Christmas and have Christmas parties in public schools, which was the issue. He told the story of he picked up his kid at school one day, and his son was talking about the holiday tree they had in class.
And, right, and, the holiday tree.
You know, Representative Bohack says, well, what's a holiday tree? And he says, that's like a Christmas tree, but we
it's
can't.
But it's a mesquite tree. Yeah. It's not a pine or whatever, cedar.
Yeah.
So this is in direct response to, like, what is it, winter solstice?
Yeah, right, exactly. That, yes, doing, okay, the seasons change and we all have our pagan urges to go shopping.
Right, eat candy canes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So now, after this, they had a big press conference when Governor Perry signed the bill. There were a whole bunch of Santa Claus lookalikes, including Senate co-sponsor Robert Nichols.
They were all white, though.
Indeed, yeah. This is if your personal Santa Claus is white, then you would have found plenty to choose from in that room. I'm sorry, I was stuck on my joke about how much Robert Nichols looks like Santa Claus. So now it's supposed to be safe to say Merry Christmas in public schools, and one elementary school parent in Frisco didn't get the memo and started organizing a holiday party where there was no red and green allowed and no Christmas trees, and you couldn't say Merry Christmas, you could only say Happy Holidays, because, you know, this is the way people had gotten used to doing it in some schools where they'd been told this is, you know, we can't have religious stuff in our public schools. And so Pat Fallon, who's a Republican representative from up there, heard about this and sounded the Christmas alarm and organized an urgent parents meeting in Frisco to address the issue. And people started going on Fox News, talking about, you know, once again, we have the war on Christmas in Texas and Frisco of all places, which was the subject of a whole book by a Wall Street Journal reporter on the American Christmas culture and shopping. Like, this is the city that loves Christmas already. So it's a strange place for the war to be breaking out. But here it is again. Dan Patrick, who's running for lieutenant governor, has started collecting signatures on his campaign site for people to sign a petition against the war on Christmas. It's kind of strange.
He's really just collecting emails. That's what all these petitions that politicians are doing now.
Yeah.
That's grabbing people's emails, putting them on a listserv. But,
sucking them right up, but yeah.
But there you go.
Yeah, I mean, if you care about the war on Christmas, then maybe you care about Dan Patrick. And he says, I will make a stand against the war on Christmas. So he's bringing up this sort of straw man war on Christmas and then saying he's opposed to
He's declaring to the entire a war. On the war on
yeah.
Christmas.
He's like a war on Christmas peacenik. You know, he's not saying which side he's on. He's saying he doesn't like the war at all. Go ahead.
Does this ever end, or is this just one of those culture war flashpoints that, frankly, you know, both sides or what, at least, you know, some interested parties have a reason to keep going indefinitely and perpetually?
It's just a holiday tradition now. It just happens every year. I'm looking forward to Bill O'Reilly's next year's book, Killing Santa. I think that'll
And be does the war on Christmas start earlier every year, or is that just me?
Yeah, it seems like it does. but I mean, this stuff came up, speaking of religion in schools, even just this week, there was a lieutenant governor's debate where the four Republican candidates for the job all seemed like they endorsed teaching creationism to some extent in public schools.
And or creationalism.
And or.
Right. Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst came straight out of the gate and he said, you know, I happen to believe in creationalism. He meant creationism, of course. I think it was just a verbal tick there.
This is how far you have to go to distinguish yourself in this race when everyone agrees.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible because this guy
make up new words.
you know, there's a lot of things to criticize him about, but I think that generally is considered to be a guy who's interested in policy, you know, who takes himself, who considers himself to be, you know, get in the weeds and the nuts and bolts of how to run the state. And, you know, he's having to pander so far now that he's, I believe man walked with dinosaur.
I'm not saying there's more than one, but yeah, no, it never ends. And it's here again. So, Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Or happy holidays or whatever will not offend your boat. Forrest, I believe you have a story for us about the payday loan industry and something going on with that in Houston.
Yeah, so this week the Houston City Council passed overwhelmingly, I think a little bit more overwhelmingly than some people had expected, a payday loan ordinance, 15-2, 15 in favor, 2 against. That is similar to payday loan regulations that have been passed now by every major city in the state of Texas except for Fort Worth. So El Paso, Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, Houston being the kind of, I guess, the holy grail because it's the biggest city. And, you know, Houston has a pretty laissez-faire approach to business in general. Initially, it was thought that Mayor Parker, Anise Parker, would probably come forward with a quote-unquote compromise ordinance, which would be a little bit weaker than what the other cities had done. But she opted, in fact, to do something a little bit stronger, more along the lines of what the consumer advocates and some of the faith groups have gotten involved in this issue wanted. And it passed overwhelmingly. And the message from some of the council members who were somewhat hesitant to vote in favor of the ordinance was the state of Texas hasn't done anything, so it falls to us to at least make some efforts, no matter how flawed, to try to bring some sense and regulation to what's an out-of-control kind of consumer finance marketplace.
And so what do these regulations actually do? What do they accomplish?
Well, there's a variety of different aspects to them. They don't – what other states have done and what consumer advocates would probably really like to do is put some sort of cap on the interest rate. Mm-hmm. Right now, Texas is ground zero for these type of loans. We have no limits statewide on what you can charge people in terms of a rate. So,
which is very different from other states.
It's very different. Some states have banned them. Some states have very stringent caps. Here, you know, it's not unusual to take out a payday or auto title loan that exceeds 500% APR. So what these do is they try to limit the size of the loan based on people's income. That might be the most important thing that they do. And I won't go into the weeds on that. It's a way to not mess with the interest rate, but still try to limit the size and the number of times that people roll the loans over so they don't get trapped in a debt cycle.
And in your story about this, you mentioned who did the reporting? There's a story about a woman who actually is like getting payday loans to pay for other payday loans.
Oh, I mean that's
pretty commonplace.
Oh, yes, absolutely, because that's the debt trap. That's the cycle of debt. You take out a loan that you never could afford in the first place. You're obligated to pay it. You don't pay down the principal. So yeah, some people will go to another payday loan shop to take out a loan to help pay for the first one. And you can see this probably isn't going to end well. If everything else stays equal, you have the same job paying the same amount, the same bills that are coming due every month. You're not going to get out of it probably.
You buy yourself some time.
You buy yourself some
what
time.
Else can
kick
you
the
do?
Can down the road.
Yeah. Right.
This is not unusual at all. Lisa Falkenberg, who's a columnist for the Houston Chronicle, wrote a really great piece this week, basically calling out one of the city councilmen. I think her piece was titled, "This Payday Loan Column is for You, Jason Rodriguez." As a council member, and he ended up voting against the measure. She pointed out that one of his close friends and a groomsman at his wedding is a lobbyist for Cash America, one of the big chains. He refuses to answer questions about he's going to leave office soon, about whether or not he's going to go work for the industry. So there's a lot of tension around this issue,
right?
And but there was a victory certainly for the consumer side of things this week.
And so does it look like Fort Worth is going to jump on board with this?
I'm not exactly sure what the local politics are. I think, you know, Fort Worth tends to be a little bit of a more conservative city. It's probably arguably maybe the only major city left in Texas that is still controlled by Republicans. Other than that, I can't tell you.
I mean, you've written before about how much influence the payday loan industry has in the state and how powerful their lobbyists are. And that I guess is one of the reasons why it looked for a while like there was going to be some action at the state level this year,
right?
And then it just kind of evaporated.
Yeah, and that's why the action has moved to the city level. And I think this, it's interesting because you would think, well, you know, there's campaign finance issues at the city level. Certainly, industry can exert influence on council members or mayors. But I think because city government is so much closer to the day-to-day lives of the citizenry, that it becomes much harder for the industry to exert, to flex its muscle in the way they did at the state capitol.
They're hearing more directly from constituents.
That's right. Like, and so did the legislature, but I don't think the money talks quite as much at the local level. And plus, I think, you know, what you hear from these council members around the state is this is not something that we deal with. I mean, we don't regulate finance typically. It's not something cities do. We don't want to do this. We don't think we're the appropriate level of government to be grappling with this. But in the absence of anything from the legislature year after year after year, session after session, we have to act even if it's imperfectly. So that's what's happened.
Cool. Well, thanks for sharing these stories.
Sure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. Patrick Michaels has been following the story of a man from Jasper, Texas, who went missing and was later found dead. Patrick, can you give us an update on the story?
Sure. I think I've even mentioned it on the show before. And at the time, the case was just kind of this baffling story of a guy named Alfred Wright, who is 28 years old, is from Jasper and had gone to college in Tennessee and come back, and he has a family there. He was, you know, had lots of friends and lots of family around there. And this one night in November, he up and disappeared in a town kind of in the country outside a town called Hemphill, just northwest of Jasper. And he had just been on the phone. He was like, his truck was broken down. He was waiting to get picked up by his folks. And then all of a sudden, he took off running down the highway. And was apparently not seen again. There was a search for him that turned up some of his clothes and his belongings down a kind of a country road off the highway, a little away from the store where he'd gone missing from. But they couldn't find any sign of him other than that. There was a 3-day search that the county sheriff did, and then the Sabine County Sheriff called it off and said there's no more searching we can do. He said they kept their investigation going, but calling off the ground search at that point struck a lot of people as being too soon. And it got very contentious right away because Alfred Wright was black. Mm-hmm. And this is in Jasper, which is, I think, well known nationwide as the place where James Byrd, who's a black man, was picked up by white supremacists in 1998 on off the side of the road, and then dragged in this horrific murder behind their truck, and it sort of captivated everyone. And really, that's the story that the folks in Jasper still can't live down now. It's sort of become this. It stands for all kinds of racist history in Deep East Texas and white supremacist groups that have been around there for a long time. So, you know, the mysterious situation here with Alfred Wright sort of got people suspicious right away. And his family contacted a lot of activists and folks with local chapters of Al Sharpton's civil rights group, Quan LX in Houston, who's a community activist. And you know, a lot of attention kind of came to this from outside as well, and local officials who were white, the mayor of Jasper and the county sheriff, Sabine County Sheriff Tom Maddox, were saying, look, you know, we understand people are upset, but we're doing all we can, and we're doing our investigation the way we can. His body turned up just before Thanksgiving in a search that wasn't done by officials; it was done by friends and family of Alfred Wright. It was right next to, just a few yards away from where his stuff was found, in a place that seemed like it would have been searched already, but here his body was. So now we're waiting on autopsy results to see if there's any sign of what was going on. And there were some preliminary findings from the official autopsy that said there was no sign of trauma. It seems like, you know, this wasn't a homicide. The family hired their own pathologist that they said would be an independent one, who said that she did think there were signs of homicide here, and she was surprised to see that someone had said there was no sign of trauma.
I want to back up the thing that kind of blows my mind here. His body was found, was it 100 yards or something like that?
About 100 yards, yeah.
It's unfathomable that wasn't found.
And the sheriff's department told you and others that they were conducting an extensive search. They had dogs out.
And there are pictures, yeah. There are lots of folks were out there.
Somebody had a plane.
Yeah.
They had search parties. How in the heck could they miss a body that was 100 yards from where he was last spotted?
Yeah. And they're, I mean, they're just, the whole thing is full of rumors and suspicion now. I mean,
maybe he could have been moved there later or something.
Right, exactly. That's one of the rumors or ideas that people have. And at this point, we just don't know. But I think, you know, and we're going to find out soon. You can check TexasObserver.org. We're going to have updates. But soon there will be results from the autopsy and toxicology. The sheriff said that he's going to have a press release out that explains things from their perspective. But it really seems now as if this is only sort of the beginning of a conflict here that's sort of years and years of pent up frustration from a lot of folks in the Black community who you know, tell stories about relatives who have just disappeared without a trace and no investigation was done or not a very good investigation. And they fear this is the same kind of thing that happens again. So if the press release comes out and says, you know, it doesn't look like there's anything suspicious and it's all, you know, there's nothing for us left to do. There are going to be a lot of people who are upset and they're talking about protests and trying to get some kind of action from federal investigators or just looking what other options they have to get some attention here because a lot of people are just really unsatisfied.
I mean, but right now, I mean, I guess there's a lot more unanswered questions than there are, you know, known facts in this case.
Yeah, and that's really true. I mean, there's so much speculation as well. I mean, the reason I think that it's interesting and why, you know, it's worth covering from a statewide perspective is just the strangeness of this crime and the way that people have kind of...
But what was the crime?
I'm sorry. Yeah, not necessarily
potential
a crime. Potential
yeah.
crime. Yeah, the circumstances, you know, call it the case. But the way that people have attached to it and this sort of movement that it seems to be generating that people are getting interested in what's happening here. And there's a huge spotlight, you know, being shined on small town law enforcement agency.
Is it possible to talk about this case without reference to the history, or is that so important to telling the story?
That's the division, I think, that the folks in law enforcement will say that you have to talk. I mean, we're dealing with evidence here, and what do we see? We don't see any evidence of a crime necessarily. And you know, the history is what it is, but we're talking about this one particular case, and not everything has to do with James Byrd or with – but then there's the list. There's the a little bit before James Byrd, there was a Black man who was beaten to death in the Sabine County Jail on Christmas Eve. And then just a few months ago, there was a woman picked up by police in Jasper who were caught on videotape beating her inside the police station, and there was a big settlement for that. So you know, there's this twin thing happening where law enforcement says this is just about an isolated incident, and you can't make too much out of it. But then at the same time, there is this history, and activists and friends of the family are saying, well, all these other pieces of the history sure make us suspicious. And what they're saying is that law enforcement isn't doing enough to allay their concerns or make them feel better about it.
It sounds like there's not a whole lot they could do, though, maybe. Like, because this perception is already there. I mean, like, what do you do with that?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're probably on some kind of lockdown. They don't want to give out any information while they're, you know, continuing their investigation. But at the same time, the family says they're being shut out and they're frustrated. And it's this sort of radio silence from the cops that sort of allows this protest to build up. And, you know, folks from Houston and Galveston are talking about coming in and protesting. They've already had one protest outside the county sheriff's office. You know, and a lot of folks in town are just kind of baffled by all the attention. But then there are plenty of people who you know, will come out of the town to the family's lawyer's office in Beaumont and talk about how they, you know, they're afraid to talk about how concerned they are in Jasper. But once they're out of town, they feel more free to say that they, you know, just don't have much trust for local law enforcement, and they're just really worried about what could be happening here, if it's some kind of cover up, or, you know, they don't know. But
you're gonna stay on the case.
That's true. Yeah,
and I guess that this is kind of a meta question or whatever. But has this attracted much attention outside of your reporting or Houston media?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually out there on a separate story when the first news stories were out about his disappearance, and I'd seen some conversation about, you know, why isn't this a big national story? That, you know, such a strange, mysterious disappearance. It's the kind of thing that would be on cable news all the time, and not to say that that's a good thing.
If it was necessarily a teenage or young white girl on a cruise ship or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but because it's a black man in rural Texas, you know, nobody was as interested. But at the same time, in Beaumont, on the evening news, I mean, it's the number one. It was the number one story, you know, for days, and it was a you know, locally, it was very interesting to folks, and it just seems like it. There's a fair sized chance that it's just kind of getting going now,
right?
Well, thanks for that. We look forward to future reports about it.
Yeah, thanks.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. Joining us via phone is Lance Scott Walker, who spent 9 years documenting what his book describes as the most influential style in 21st century hip-hop. The book is Houston Rap. Lance Scott Walker, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit about the book. What will people get when they pick up Houston Rap?
Well, I think everybody will get something a little different, you know. It's definitely, detail-wise, it's geared for a hardcore Houston Rap fan, you know, somebody who's listened to the music for the two or three decades that they've been making it. But, you know, I think it also has a narrative that people who don't know anything about rap music can relate to, because a lot of the content of the book focuses on the neighborhoods that a lot of the rappers in Houston are from. And so when you talk about their neighborhoods, you talk about things that they grew up with and, you know, environment in which they grew up, the circumstances under which they grew up, and it's so different for everybody, but I think that, you know, people will end up drawing parallels throughout the narrative.
So what neighborhoods are talked about?
Fifth Ward is the neighborhood the Ghetto Boys are from in Houston, and that's a pretty rough neighborhood. It's definitely got a legacy. And then South Park on the south side of town, and sort of the Third Ward area, which really encompasses downtown but is a bigger part of the old outdated ward. Those are where big clusters of rappers in Houston come from. And so, you know, a lot of the stories that you hear in Houston rap music over the past 20 or 30 years come from those neighborhoods. And so, you know, what the book does is sort of gives you a different layer of that, kind of a different way of a different dialogue of talking about some of the same things.
So one of the things that really impressed me about this book is that I understand you spent 9 years working on this.
Yeah, well, we didn't set out to take 9 years.
So the original idea was it something a little bit shorter than that, or?
Oh, well, I think you always want to see it come out sooner when you're working on it. But, you know, 9 years was just the length of time it took us, you know, working on it and getting it put together and the whole, you know, editing process and production process. You know, it really, that's the part where you really make the book. You know, you spend a lot of time collecting stuff. You spend a lot of time doing interviews and taking pictures. But it's really when you get down to the editing process that you want to make something that will really communicate and tell a story. And so we didn't set out to take that long, but I'm glad we did, because if we would have done the book, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago, it wouldn't have been the same kind of thing.
What initially sparked this idea?
Well, it was Peter's idea. You know, Peter and I are both from the Houston area. He's from north of Houston, and I'm from Galveston, and so we grew up with this music. You know, we grew up hearing the Ghetto Boys and Royal Flush and Raheem and some of the early Houston artists and hearing Rap-A-Lot records. And so, you know, it's a part of your childhood if you grew up in South Texas and in most of Texas, really, for that matter. And so it was a point of interest to him to the end that he wanted to come back to Houston from, he was already living in New York, and he wanted to come back to Houston and take pictures of all the guys that, you know, he grew up listening to and hearing about, because he wondered where they were, you know, 20 years down the line, or I guess it was more like 10 years at that point. But, you know, he wanted to catch up with them and see where they were. And maybe 6 months in, he came to me and he said, I've been shooting these guys, and it's a lot bigger than just photos. You should come on board and interview everybody and make it a real story. And so that's how we got rolling. That was early 2005, and, you know, we've just been plugging away ever since.
So is there a particular interview that stands out for you?
Well, MC Wicked Cricket's interview, I think, is one of the most important ones in the book, because he is really old school. You know, he came to Houston in the late 1970s from New York City and settled in Fifth Ward. And so he was an early guy that was mixed in with the clubs in Houston when they were just freestyling, and before, where you were starting to hear some rap in the clubs, but before there were any rappers. And, you know, he was really one of the first ones. And so his interview is interesting on that point, but it's also interesting because he talks about the crack trade, and, you know, how that changed the mentality of the neighborhoods that he grew up in, and how that changed so many different things in society, really across, you know, different demographics. And so I think that was a really important interview in for both books. You know, it's in Houston Rap, the photo book, and it's also reprinted in full in the second book, Houston Rap Tapes, when that comes out in February. So his is really important because without him telling us those stories, they wouldn't be in the book, and they're a really, really important part of understanding those neighborhoods.
I mean, perhaps this goes without saying, but this book is much more than just about a music scene. This is sort of an anthropological look at a piece of Houston. Is that what you guys initially set out to do?
I wouldn't say that, but we were happy to arrive there. You know, I think that we set out to look at the world of Houston rappers through as intimate a lens as we could, and then we created the story from what we found. So to know that we were going to get as deep as we did and get the stories that we did, no, I don't think we ever expected that. I mean, the depth of the knowledge and the wisdom and the stories and everything like that that we've continued to uncover over the year, you know, continually surprised us both.
Can you speak to what sort of reactions you've had from the book? Have you shared this with any of the people that you actually interviewed for the book?
Yeah, we've tried to reach out to share it with everybody. I mean, we're trying to get copies to people. We came to Texas in early December, and we did a tour of the state. We went to Houston, Austin, San Antonio, and Marfa. And no rappers in Marfa, but we did get books to rappers in Houston and San Antonio. I mean, Houston and Austin. And I think the response has been largely positive. I mean, you're certainly worried when you're telling someone's history and you're putting together a document of their histories and, you know, and really inserting their story into it. You worry that you're going to get it right and that you're going to do them justice. And so, you know, you never, that feeling never really settles because there's so many people whose lives are really affected, you know, when they're a part of something like that. And so, but I think the response has been positive. Yeah.
What is the aspect of Houston's rap scene that really sets it apart?
A lot of people will point to the slowdown sound, you know, the slowed down music that DJ Screw popularized throughout the 90s, and which was derived from, you know, an older Houston DJ named Daryl Scott, who would slow down some songs on old mixtapes of his, but never to the extreme that Screw did. So you could, you know, people will always point to that, and they'll always say, well, you know, the Houston sound is the slowed down sound, but there's so many different sounds in Houston. There's so many different groups that don't rap about the same things that people in the Screwed Up Click would rap about. Those are the ones who, you know, popularized the slower music. You know, Devin the Dude, Street Military, Ghetto Boys, South Park Coalition, you know, they're all very, very different sounds in Houston. And, you know, of course, we look at the big drums and the buzzing bass and, you know, a lot of West Coast influence. And, you know, the Houston lyrical content is usually darker. So it's a really complex thing. I hope we tap into that in some of the interviews and some of the quotes where people are talking about that, and certainly in when they discover the music, when people discover the music.
Well, Lance Scott Walker, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can read excerpts of Lance Scott Walker's book, Houston Rap, on texasobserver.org in January. It will also be featured in the January issue. We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.